move now to appeal numbers 25-2188 and 25-2189, United States v. Malcolm Whiteside. We'll begin with oral argument, Mr. Giesfeld, on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning. It may please the court. Matthew Giesfeld, on behalf of the appellant, Malcolm Whiteside. Your Honors, this case revolves around one central issue. A juror's misconduct exposed that juror and potentially others to an outsider's opinion that Mr. Whiteside was guilty.
How so? What did the outsider know about the case?
The outsider didn't know anything new about the case, Your Honor. You're exactly right. But what the outsider did was take the information that the juror provided to them and surmised and opined as to Mr. Whiteside's guilt. And I understand completely that this doesn't fall into the normal trap or type of case that you might see with Remmer, where it's information about a witness, information about the defendant, information about the process. But this is like the case of Vasquez Ruiz, where the external contact that demanded a Remmer hearing was not evidentiary in nature. It was an opinion of guilt. And the sequence of the conversation between the juror and the outsider demonstrates that the juror didn't offer the opinion of guilt first. It was the outsider's opinion, and then the juror adopted it.
Well, wait a minute. How do you draw that last conclusion? Then the juror probably adopted it based on the overwhelming evidence of guilt, not what somebody told him who knew nothing about the case.
That's a fair point, Your Honor, and of course, the court can and should consider the totality of the circumstances. Remmer are constitutional issues. Constitutional issues demand Chapman analysis to determine the harmfulness, but that harmfulness, Your Honor, considers the totality, and the strength of the evidence is but one factor. And in this case, this court obviously should and does pay deference to the district court's findings and interpretations of the evidence, because the district court was there, heard everything, and this court was not. However, the district court only committed about a paragraph at the end of its written decision and order describing the strength of the evidence. The district court noted some incriminatory evidence against Mr. Whiteside, and then in a conclusory fashion,
his DNA on the firearm.
That's
pretty damning evidence.
2 points on that one, Your Honor. First of all, again, the district court didn't address why Mr. Whiteside's case was, as it concluded, feeble. It didn't describe any of the evidence that Mr. Whiteside elicited. And he did, pro se, elicit cross-examination evidence that nobody saw him directly with the gun. And with regard to the DNA analyst, he solicited evidence that the presence of the DNA was not just positive proof that he possessed it. He'd been in the car. His DNA was on other stuff, and Mr. Whiteside did solicit that opened that line of inquiry on cross-examination, and the district court didn't necessarily address that. But, Your Honors, the strength of the evidence here, I think, is the probative value of the strength of the evidence is mitigated by the absence of curative instruction. As I said, evidence is one of many factors that should be considered in the totality, and the government didn't produce any evidence that the juror remained impartial. And so the more assurances that were there, that could have been there, that demonstrated that the jurors were not influenced by this outside opinion, that they were only considering the strength of the evidence, that gives more probative value to the court's analysis.
What would the curative instruction have been?
The curative instruction would have been, I think, pretty simple, Your Honor. It would have been a reminder that the juror's duty is to follow or decide the case strictly on the evidence, and I think importantly here, to specifically disregard any outsider's opinion about what the facts might be, and an admonishment and a reminder for the juror not to share facts about the case with outsiders. When we consider the strength of the evidence without the curative, it becomes less about predicting what the jury did. The Remmer cases talk about the state of mind and the impartiality of the jury. If we have this unknown variable about how much one or potentially more jurors had that outsider's opinion in the back of their mind, the consideration of the strength of the evidence becomes a little less figuring out what the jury did and a little more simply supplanting the district court's view of what the jury should have done based on the evidence.
Could a curative instruction have done more damage than good? It's always a dilemma that a trial judge like Judge Peterson here is going to have by accentuating something that might have gone in one ear and out the other versus, no, this is of a level of importance that we want to make sure the jury knows not to go there.
I would say, Your Honor, I don't think there's a heightened risk of a curative being harmful for two reasons. One is, this was not part of the trial. It wasn't something that the other jurors heard. Maybe Judge Peterson could have done a curative instruction with juror number one alone, and it would have been something where it would just be reminding the juror about what his duty was. And secondly, it's so important because it is the ultimate question before the court. It's not as if it's drawing attention to otherwise bad evidence. I've been in trials, Your Honor, where I didn't want certain evidence being heard by the jury, and I had to make a strategic decision. Do I want to call attention to this to emphasize that bad evidence to the jury? And that is a strategic decision that is hard to make. In this instance, the jury knew what their question was. Their question was, is he guilty or is he innocent? There's not, going back to Judge Kirsch's point right off the bat, the category of this external evidence is such that it doesn't pose a heightened risk of a curative instruction being more harmful than valuable.
What did you mean when you said 30 seconds ago this isn't a situation where the other jurors heard it? Meaning there's no indication that the other jurors heard the telephone call that was on the speakerphone in the foyer outside the courtroom?
If I think I meant to say whether other jurors heard it. The stipulation of the parties was such that juror number one definitely heard it, and we can't forego or foreclose on the possibility that other jurors heard it as well. In this totality, we've talked a lot today so far about the strength of the evidence. I'd like to point to the clearly prejudicial aspects of the situation, of the totality. As Remmer pointed out, the Supreme Court pointed out in Remmer, some misconduct is harmful if it casts doubt on the preservation of an impartial jury. And several aspects of the totality do that here. First of which is the nature of the contact itself. We've already talked about this briefly. It's the ultimate issue before the jury. And just like this court held in Vasquez Ruiz, the ultimate question before the jury is one that is intrusive and certainly gives rise to the Remmer presumption. This wasn't innocuous. It wasn't like a juror encountering some of the defendant's family in a sandwich shop like the Moore case. It wasn't cumulative like the Coney case, where it was evidence that had already been admitted into evidence sent back to the jury room. It wasn't irrelevant. It wasn't like the victim's family member screaming that this case was racist from the gallery. That's not related to anything about the case. And it wasn't procedural in nature. It didn't talk about just the mechanics of the court. It went to the actual issue, the ultimate issue for the jury. Another harmful aspect, Your Honors, is that the juror agreed. And as the reply brief kind of parsed out, maybe the jury already had that opinion ahead of time, as Judge Kirsch noted beforehand, but whether it's agreement with or agreement from, it still gives rise to prejudice because we have a direct impact, direct evidence of pre-deliberations and talking about the issue of guilt before Mr. Whiteside presented his case and before jury instructions occurred.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time for rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you very much. Giesfeld. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. We'll now move to argument on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Lennon.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Colleen Lennon, and I represent the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion first in finding that the juror's premature deliberation was non-prejudicial to the defendant. Second, in finding that there was no reasonable possibility that the external contact, the phone call, affected the verdict. Additionally, the court properly revoked the defendant's supervised release. Before proceeding with my argument, I'd like to make a couple of corrections that I discovered in finalizing my preparation in the government's brief. There are two citations in the brief, one to United States versus Maxwell. It's represented as a Seventh Circuit case. That's a Second Circuit case. It's cited for the broad principle that broad discretion is given to the district court in deciding Rule 33 motions. Second, the citation to the United States versus Cate, that is referenced as a Seventh Circuit case. It is a Ninth Circuit case, and it's cited for the general and widely accepted principle that a revocation sentence is reviewed for reasonableness. And I apologize.
Thank you. Those will be noted for the record.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I'll first start with discussing the external contact and that there was no reasonable possibility that the external contact affected the verdict. The defendant noted or discussed the power of a curative instruction in this case. However, that could not happen in this case because the phone call was first brought to the court's attention nearly 2 weeks after the verdict. Therefore, that is not at play in this case because it was brought to the attention not during trial, as most of the cases in this case involve, but after trial, where Federal Rule of Evidence 606B applies. Concerning the external contact, according to Remmer, any private communication or contact with a juror during trial about the matter before the jury is presumptively prejudicial. However, this presumption can be overcome. Ultimately, the decision for the district court is whether there was a reasonable possibility that the contact affected the verdict. This is a highly deferential standard for a reason. That is because the district court is in the best position to evaluate all of the circumstances, having observed the trial and the jury's demeanor, to determine whether there was it was reasonably possible that the jury's verdict was impacted. To reverse, this court must have a strong conviction of error. In fact, in United States versus Brusino, that was a case where this court corrected the panel for stating the correct standard of review, which was an abuse of discretion, but then incorrectly conducted a de novo inquiry into whether the documents shown to the jury were prejudicial. The defendant likens his case to Vasquez Ruiz, where the word guilty was written on a juror's notebook by an anonymous source, and the juror reported this during trial and reported feeling threatened. Well, this is different from the case before the court here today. The juror reported this during trial, where the court would have an opportunity to correct the action. This was brought to the court's attention 2 weeks after verdict, and Rule 606B applies. That would limit any questioning of the juror. The juror could not be asked the ultimate question, which is whether this phone call impacted their deliberations. As noted in Tanner, when allegations of juror misconduct are brought days, weeks, months after trial, this frustrates the process and frustrates the finality of a verdict. Here, the court properly, under the circumstances, given its situation, considered the proper factors in evaluating the phone call based on the record it had, the stipulated record it had. The court evaluated the extent and nature of the contact. The court specifically noted that the contact was brief, that no extraneous information was provided by the third party. The third party offered a response, but primarily the juror was the one who was speaking and providing information about the case. There were no threatening statements, such as in Vasquez Ruiz or even in Remmer. There was no attempt to influence during this phone call. The court considered the power of its own instructions, its instructions to the broader jury, to disregard any outside information. And finally, and most probatively, the court did properly consider the strength of the government's case. As this panel already noted, there was DNA on the firearm here. There was also additional supporting evidence, which included testimony from the truck driver where the vehicle crashed into the truck, dash cam video, which showed an individual running in the direction where the defendant was ultimately found in this case.
Clothing matched?
The clothing matched the description.
They followed him into the Home Depot parking lot and found him in the storage shed?
Nearby, yes. Additionally, there was a jail phone call that was introduced that the defendant placed to his girlfriend and the registered owner of the vehicle, where he expressed regret about recent events.
Ms. Lennon, let's suppose for a minute that we agree with you that the district court denying the motion for a new trial did not reflect any error at all or any abuse of discretion. Does that resolve functionally, effectively, the supervised release issue before us?
That does, because the court's decision on the Rule 33 determination is not related to the supervised release decision. That's because the court properly revoked the defendant's supervised release by considering the evidence presented at trial.
Yeah, that's what I mean. In other words, if the conviction stands that there's not going to be a new trial, there's no prejudice or whatever, I'm just assume this for purposes of the question, we'll have to decide it, then I don't see what's left of the challenge to the supervised release. There would be a valid conviction for possessing a firearm that would have violated Title 18 and simultaneously violated the conditions of a supervised release.
Yes, you're correct, Your Honor. Your decision in the first matter, it would lead that the court would uphold the district court's revocation. I'll turn next to the second point regarding the juror's misconduct, the pre-deliberative statements. The district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the juror's misconduct was non-prejudicial, in that the juror was discussing the case prior to deliberation. The court properly relied on precedent, experience, and common sense to determine that the juror's pre-deliberation statements were non-prejudicial to the defendant. The court primarily relied on United States versus Farmer. It's analogous because it involved jurors commenting on the defendant's guilt before deliberation. As noted in Tanner, jurors are human beings, and attempts to achieve perfection would likely do more harm than good. Such practice would threaten the finality of verdicts and invite losing parties to harass jurors. The court here correctly and did not abuse its discretion in finding that the jury had just heard overwhelming evidence of guilt against the defendant. This phone call was placed after the government's close of evidence, but prior to the defendant's case. The defendant's case was cumulative, and the court noted that the defendant called existing law enforcement witnesses in questioning them about their reports. Therefore, it's unrealistic to think that a juror would not have been thinking about this case and considering the overwhelming evidence that it just heard in this phone call. Lastly, and I'll just point, because we've already discussed it, that the supervised release issue, Your Honor, is correct. If this court upholds the district court's decision in the first matter, the supervised release revocation follows. The defense, in its reply, refers to a package deal argument. This is typically reserved for cases where a single count of a multi-count indictment is successfully attacked, and therefore the entire case in itself would be sent to address the sentencing factors in 18 United States Code 3553 sub A. However, the district court did not abuse its discretion in first revoking the defendant's supervised release. He stipulated to a drug use violation that leads to mandatory revocation. The court also properly considered the evidence presented at trial. It's irrespective of the jury's verdict. The court is the one to decide supervised release, and the court properly decided by preponderance of the evidence that that violation was satisfied. Additionally, the court's sentence was reasonable. Given all of these points, Your Honors, that the court did not abuse its discretion in finding that there was no reasonable possibility that the external contact affected the verdict, and that the juror's misconduct was not prejudicial to the defendant, and additionally, that the court properly revoked the defendant's supervised release, we ask that Your Honors affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lennon. Mr. Giesfeld, rebuttal. A question for you. It's 2 weeks prior to the affidavit coming into the district court after the trial ends. Is that a function of the fact that Mr. Whiteside had represented himself pro se, had standby counsel? Standby counsel then got activated as full counsel post-trial. that's when the affidavit then was filed. Is that correct?
100%, Your Honor, and that was one of the 2 points I wanted to raise. The Rule 33 motion was filed timely. The government didn't object procedurally to it, and it was absolutely a function of that. Mr. Whiteside didn't invoke his right to counsel until after the jury trial came in, asked counsel to, as outlined in the pleadings, asked counsel to investigate, talk with mom. Counsel, we tried to get the footage from the U.S. Marshals Service that would have shown this phone call occurring. Didn't happen because it wasn't preserved. Absolutely, Your Honor, that was a function of a defense investigation and Mr. Whiteside appearing pro se. Judge Scudder, I agree with you. If the court does not overturn the conviction, the supervised release stays put. Absolutely agree with that. And my point in reply is only that I agree with my colleague, Attorney Lennon. Normally, package deal cases are for multiple convictions. The Ninth Circuit has taken the position that you can do revocations and convictions together. I think that makes sense here. I ask the court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Giesfeld. Thank you, Ms. Lennon. The case will be taken under advisement.